It's 12 o'clock and time now for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Hisham Mattar published his first novel, In the Country of Men, in 2006, and it was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. You have a rather fascinating background, because although you're Libyan, Hisham, you were actually born in New York, weren't you?
I was. I have a very mischievous autobiography, so one of the ways of simplifying it is in numbers.
Yes.
So 0 to 3 is New York. Yeah. The reason being is my father was a diplomat. 3 to 9... is Libya. 9 to 15 is, well, actually 9 to 10 in Kenya, then 10 to 15 in Egypt. Mm-hmm. My parents left Libya when things got quite difficult and complicated politically. And then when I was 15, they sent me here to school and I stayed. I went to university and made a home for myself in London.
Yeah, and we should say that the family essentially moved to Egypt, if I'm correct, because there was a fear that the Libyan government... Well, the life was becoming quite difficult there.
Life was becoming difficult in the sense that what frightened my parents most is that the schools became militarized. And so at the age of 14, you were, you know, obliged to wear a military uniform, carry a gun, crawl in the morning, do all these exercises. And there was a war going on with Chad. So there were boys as young as 16 being sent there. So my mother and my father got very worried about that. My brother had an older brother who was edging closer to 14. He was 13 when we left. And so we left for that reason. 10 years after we left Egypt, by then my brother and I were at university here. My father was kidnapped from his home in Cairo by Egyptian security personnel. And then the following day, it was put on an airplane, and he went to Libya. We didn't know that. We thought he was kept in Egypt. They kept promising us that he's in Egypt, but also sort of threatening us not to speak out, not to make too much noise. They would say things like, if you make too much noise, we can't guarantee his return. We can't guarantee. So the best thing you can do for him is to be silent.
That's a double-edged sword, isn't it, really? You keep silent so nothing happens.
Yeah.
Make a noise, you're putting him in danger. It's blackmail.
Exactly. But then 2 years after the abduction, he managed to smuggle a letter out of Abu Slim, the political prisoner in Libya. And in it, he detailed exactly what happened, that he was taken back to Libya the following day.
It's impossible reading the book In the Country of Men, which I found riveting and very beautiful, not to take that background into consideration.
Mm.
And obviously it must have coloured your writing of it, even though it's not a work of autobiography.
I have a very complicated relationship with my country. It's a country that has given me a great deal of joy and love, but also a great deal of pain and loss. But you know what's really interesting about what happened in the late 1970s in Libya is how the regime successfully infiltrated all civic life. So the last place that was relatively free was the home. So all of the poetry, all of the music, all of the interesting discussions took place within that privacy. So I tried also to create another character in the book, being the house itself.
And what was the music of your childhood? What kind of music would you have been listening to at that time?
A lot of classical Arabic music, but also Beethoven and Mozart, whom I still don't understand. I'm fascinated by him, but I don't understand what he's doing at all. But,
well, let's hear some of the music that surrounded you, which is not Western classical.
Mm.
Which is the first piece you've chosen?
The first piece... it's Shidd al-Hizam, which is by Sayyid Darwish. Sayyid Darwish died very young. He died 31 in 1923 from taking a little bit too much cocaine than is good for you. But he wrote these wonderful folk songs that told stories about the daily lives of farmers and of carpenters. And as a child, I remember my parents used to go to the theater a lot. And Egyptian theater goes on for hours. And so... it was fun, but not always for me. But the highlight was on the way to the theatre, there was usually a puppeteer outside. And the puppeteers used a lot of Seyyed Darwish's songs. And so this is a rare recording of Seyyed Darwish himself singing it in the 19-teens. I don't know when exactly, but around that time.
It's very much the music of a meeting place of cultures, in a sense. You know, you've almost got kind of Western chords playing, and yet the melody is very Arabic and modal.
Well, Egypt in the turn of the century was a very exciting place. Lots of people from all over the world living there, many from Western Europe, particularly in places like Alexandria, and he was from Alexandria. But the refrain is, tighten the belt, nothing else would do.
Seyyed Darwish. Well, you mentioned your problems with Mozart, Hisham, and we'll probably come on to that later. Not so with Chopin?
No, not so with Chopin. Chopin really seems extremely close to life, or to the life I know it. You see, there's something peculiar that I was thinking about on the way here that I don't know, maybe it isn't peculiar, but it seemed peculiar to me just thinking of it in these terms, that most of my relationship to Western music, architecture, literature, but even some of the Arabic arts, seems to be going in reverse, that I get obsessed with a composer who only about 20 years ago was working, and then he would lead me back. So Schnittke to Beethoven to, you know, or Hemingway and Faulkner to Don Quixote. It seemed to me like what everybody else is doing is that, you know, the sensible folks have read Don Quixote when they're kids, and then it moves. So, but Chopin feels very close in this sense. And I suppose with this piece, particularly the so-called revolutionary etude, the urgency in it, the vitality and the desire to attend to a historical moment, being, you know, the November uprising here that he was too ill to take part in, maybe he was too ill to take part in, seems to highlight something that I'm interested in, which is how history at times seems fixed on crushing the artist. And, you know, he is trying to attend to it, but at the same time remain independent.
Sviatoslav Richter playing the Chopin study in C minor, opus 10, number 12, known as The Revolutionary. Well, it is another piece of music from your part of the world we have next. A farewell song for an exile, really, which I suppose you are in some ways.
Yes, it's Fairuz from Lebanon. I remember her when I was very young. The thing that really made me sort of take notice of Fairuz was the fact that she didn't leave Lebanon during the Civil War. And then the other thing that made me take notice is that she came to Egypt for a rare concert. My father went out and bought 15 tickets. We went, a whole group of us, to the concert. She didn't turn up until about 11:30. She played until 3 in the morning. It was right at the desert, right behind the pyramids, so it was spectacular. The Giza pyramids are the backdrop to Fairuz. And then afterwards, we went to the Oberoi, which is right next to the pyramids, for breakfast, because this thing went on until about, by the time we were out, it was past 4. We didn't know she was staying at the Oberoi. So there I was, making my way to the toilets, and I meet her in the corridor, freeze in front of her. But this song is, it is a farewell. And what she says is, it's a very peculiar song, because most of the Arabic songs are, if they're addressing the individual and the group, it's always about how the individual can never do without the group, how the individual is part of the group and the group is part of him or her. And so this one is a little bit unusual in that. She says, "I must say my farewells and tell you about myself. Had I been of you, I would not sing. We sang outrageous songs and exiles' songs. And in the end, there is always the parting."
Very catchy music, and it's extraordinary in a sense, having that folk feel to it, and yet an almost Hollywood string arrangement in the background.
<That's> exactly. Exactly, and not very representative of her work, because this was later on when her son, you can notice all the jazz arrangements in the background, Ziad Rahbani got involved, and she kind of been handed from her husband to her husband was the more famous Rahbani, the composer, and so she was under his baton for most of her life, and then now her son. So yeah, but it is, yeah, Sami, it's populist music.
Feruz's farewell song. Well, next we're going to hear music from the Sibelius Violin Concerto, and a composer who I guess does have one thing in common with the music we've heard for you, which is quite a strong sense of place.
Yes, and it seems to me that most artists find it difficult to take the world as it is. Very few people, even those who are able to take it as it is, can't do that all the time. It's too difficult. But he seems to be one that does that for me. So the music always has this kind of transparency to it. And it returns, this piece that we're going to hear next, returns to this theme of the individual voice and the collective narrative. You know, it's a terrible phrase, but that, you know. But here, what happens is always surprising. You're never quite sure who is leading who at times, and who's restraining who. It seems to me sometimes the violin is restraining the orchestra, and sometimes it's the other way around.
Thank you. We heard Jascha Heifetz playing the violin in the final movement of the Sibelius Violin Concerto in D minor, Opus 47. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra were conducted by Walter Händel. You've rather nicely interspersed Western music with music that has a more Arabic lilt to it.
Very rigid structure. One. I can see now that it's a little bit too mechanical, but yeah, there we go.
So the next piece, tell us about that.
The next piece to me, we mentioned Moshahat earlier, and this is an exquisite example of a Moshah, a musical structure. I see it's like a miniature piece. It's only 1 minute and 10 seconds, but it's like a carving. It's exquisite, all of its own.
What will we be hearing about?
Its roots is in the Andalusian courts. It's a love song. Ahwa Qamaran. I am in love with the moon. Of course, the moon is not the moon. it's Ghada Shbir singing.
And a famous singer.
Ghada Shbir is known a bit here because she won, I think, the BBC Radio 3 World Music Award a couple of years ago, I believe, if I'm not wrong.
Well, the Ligeti that we're going to hear next, yeah. And one of the most original 20th century composers.
Yeah.
But he too wrote very short pieces sometimes, which say an awful lot with economic means.
Yeah.
What was your thinking behind this?
I love piano music, and not a great deal of it has been written recently. And this seems to be the most curious and the most problematic and beautiful piano music written in the last 50 years or so. It's just so fascinating.
Tempo de Valse No. 4 from Musica Ricercata by George Ligeti. It was played by Pierre-Laurent Aymard. So, if you were to be able to master an instrument, would it be a piano?
I wanted to be a conductor when I was a young boy. This was my dream. In fact, the three passions were music, architecture, and poetry. And I quickly realized I wasn't going to make it in any of those three. But the novel seems to be, actually, I regard myself as ridiculously lucky because all those three seem to be, what interested me in them is all in the novel. With music, it was conducting, and so I am conducting.
I think the next music hasn't really had the same success as some Arab music in terms of sort of world music.
Yeah, world music is a very problematic phrase. I mean, I really do very sincerely and deeply feel that everything is there. It doesn't need to be put in these compartments. The world is far more interesting and far more accessible than we make it out to be. And this is an example of a sort of Arabic music that doesn't easily have a place in the West. I mean, it depends where. In Spain, it has a place, in Germany. In fact, Sabah Fakhri was held in great regard by a lot of flamenco singers, and you'll be able to tell why. But when we were children, there were, you know, Fairuz, and of course, Umm Kulthum, the giant Egyptian diva, Sabah Fakhri, many others. But Sabah Fakhri always struck me as this kind of summit you sort of can't get to when you're young. You have to wait a while. And only in the last 5 years I began to buy his music and listen to it.
So what's it called?
Layli Layli Layl Mawal. My night, the night is a song. حبيبي على الدنيا عبادت وحشة فيا قمرا كل ما انت طالع حبيبي حبيبي
I'm not afraid.
it's like something that is spiraling, but with every repetition, something new is added, a new intonation that reveals the word. The words are incredibly powerful. It's classical poetry, but and so the singer is responsible. One of his responsibilities is to decode the words, but also to add different inflections to them. And Umm Kulthum, of course, is the giant in this, but I find it spectacular.
Saban Fakhri. Now, the song that we're going to hear next, Hisham Mata, is, to my mind, one of the most perfect songs ever written.
I'm glad you agree. I think so too. Nacht und Traum. It's night and dream, and I dream a lot. I dream every night almost.
And do you remember your dreams?
I do. They fade throughout the day. Sometimes I don't remember them when I wake up, but then something in the day would recall them. So I don't remember them all the time.
Do you ever write them down?
I do write some of them down, yes. Sometimes the dream is so beautiful that I want to return to it. And I've tried several times, you know, try to re-enter the dream. And to me, this is what the song is about also. It's the space between this life that we experience and the dream life, particularly when the dream life takes you across time boundaries to a person that you can't see or to a place that you can't see. Durch die Ruhe. Tell me why you think it's the most perfect song ever written.
It's exquisitely sung there by Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau, with Gerald Moore playing the piano. It's a simple but really beautiful melody, and then the change of harmony at just the perfect moment undoes one, I find. Schubert's Nacht und Träume. Well, back, Hisham, to your childhood, really, music from your childhood.
Yes, we had a Nubian cook who used to sing to me when I was a young boy. So this reminds me of him, but it's by Hamza al-Din, who's quite an interesting character. He is from the Egyptian side of Nubia. Nubia covers North Egypt, and part of it is in Egypt, part of it is in Sudan. And he comes from a Nubian village in southern Egypt that was erased by the Aswan High Dam. He went to Cairo, he studied engineering, he worked for the National Railway company, and then decided to study music. So he studied music and traveled across the country collecting folk songs, and developed this very pared down sound that is, here he's just playing the bendir, the tar, but he's usually on the oud.
Just explain what the tar is.
It's a drum that is shallow and wide, so you get this high sound from it, but a warm high sound. And then he went to America. Somehow he got adopted by the American folk music stars like Bob Dylan and John Baez. So he settled there and did most of his recordings there, and died in 2006, I believe.
And this is The Water Wheel.
Yes. It's one of the most perfect albums ever made, I think. This is from it. It's Song with Tar, it's called.
Thank you.
Sort of transfixing with the drumming sounds. Song with Tar from the Waterwheel album of Nubia Escalet. Hisham, we are quite familiar with Jeff Buckley's idiosyncratic voice on this programme because we've had his version of the Corpus Christi carol. What was it that attracted you to him?
He's not careful. You know, I think all singers have to have... Singing particularly seems to be a dangerous activity. It seems that you must... protect yourself, and he never had that. He was, everything he sung seemed like a high wire act. And I only recently heard him sing this "I Shall Be Released" by Bob Dylan, and the song always makes me think of my father, who is a political prisoner. But hearing him sing it somehow, it fell on my shoulders with more weight.
They say everything can be replaced, that every distance is not near. So I remember everything of every man that put me here. I see my light come shining from the west down to the east. Any day now, any day now, I shall be released. Every man needs protection. They say that every man must fall. Yet I swear I see my reflection somewhere so high above this wall. Sing. I see my light come shine from the west unto the east. Any day now, anyway now, I shall be released. To me in this lonely crowd, it's a man man who swears he's not to blame. All day long I hear his voice shouting so loud, crying out he has been framed. I see my light come shine
That was the Bob Dylan number, I Shall Be Released, sung in his own inimitable style by Jeff Buckley. So two final questions, Hisham. The first is, will we be reading a new book from you soon?
I have just finished a book that will be published spring or summer next year.
And the subject of that?
Most of it takes place in Egypt. It's about a man who is obsessed with his father. He lives in his father's houses. He wears his father's clothes. He stalks his father's lovers. He hasn't been able to do what most of us have done, which is to move in the world. He's very interested in returning to something that has...
He's trapped, right?
Yeah, he's trapped, yeah.
Well, I'm afraid my second question was going to be, has there been any news of your own father? And when
no,
was the last news?
We have launched a campaign this year with the aim of finding where he is, what has happened to him. My father is counted amongst that horrible UN phrase, enforced disappearances. So he has been disappeared by the Libyan government. We know where he was up to a certain time, but then we don't know where he was moved to.
Well, thank you, Hisham, for the really fascinating list of music and the juxtaposition of the two, which I've enjoyed enormously.
Thanks for having me.
Hisham Mattar was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week, at the same time, there's another chance to hear the artist Sam Taylor-Wood talking to Michael about her musical passions. Private Passions is a Classic Arts production for Radio 3, and the producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall.
A glorious Humperdinck confection comes to the BBC Proms on Tuesday, Hansel and Gretel. Laurent Pelly's semi-stage production of the Brothers Grimm fairy tale is performed by the Glyndebourne Festival Opera with a cast led by Alice Coote and Lydia Teuscher. And there's sure to be some drama from the Wicked Witch, who is uproariously played by tenor Wolfgang Applinger-Sperrhacker. Hansel and Gretel at the BBC Proms. Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, it's still the school holidays, at least for another few days. And if you have children, you might want to encourage them to listen to our children's prom. And that's tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Nicholas Collen and the Aurora Orchestra take a whistle-stop tour through some exciting and enchanting moments in classical music, designed to introduce younger ears to the full splendours of the Symphony Orchestra. Helping them on their journey are talented young musicians from the National Children's and National Youth Chamber Orchestras, some aged as young as 10. Adding to the fun on stage are capoeira dancers and a few additional surprises along the way. And you can hear that live here on BBC Radio 3 tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. This is BBC Radio 3. We're on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and also online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news with David Cornett.
Within the past half hour, England have beaten Pakistan in the fourth test at Lord's, which resumed this morning in spite of newspaper allegations about a betting scam. The News of the World said it paid a middleman £150,000 in return for exact details about when the Pakistani players Mohammed Amir and Mohammed Asif were to bowl no balls. A man has been arrested and four Pakistani players have given statements to the police. There's no allegation that the scam would have affected the outcome of the game. A senior member of the government has suggested that the overall tax burden will have to remain at its current level for 5 years. The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, told The Observer that the present tax levels were necessary as a significant contribution to getting the country's finances in order. Floodwaters have submerged another large Pakistani town, Sujawal, in the southern province of Sindh, causing widespread damage to buildings and forcing people to leave their homes. The waters are also threatening the historic city of Tata. The aid agency Oxfam says Pakistan will face devastating problems in the future unless flood reconstruction efforts begin immediately. The bodies of five people working for a candidate in next month's parliamentary elections in Afghanistan have been found in the western province of Herat. All the victims had been shot. They were among 10 people who were kidnapped by armed men on Wednesday. Five were later released. The Taliban said they carried out the abductions. Indonesia has issued a high alert after a volcano in the province of North Sumatra erupted for the first time for 400 years. About 10,000 villagers living around Mount Sinabung near Medan were moved to safety during the night when volcanic ash and black smoke shot hundreds of feet into the air. And the weather, very windy in eastern counties of Scotland and England, especially North Sea coasts, with showers affecting many places, some of which will be heavy and thundery. Elsewhere, it'll be breezy with occasional rain, becoming brighter throughout the day, but feeling cool. BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
Read by David Cornett. I'm Jill Anderson. Very good afternoon to you. Coming up in an hour's time, Radio 3 Requests. Fiona Talkington presents the weekly pick of listeners' favourites, including Mahler's Adagietto and Elizabeth Schwarzkopf singing Strauss. And the author, Alexander McCall Smith, makes a guest request. Then at 4 o'clock, choral evensong comes from the Priory Church of Eddington in Wiltshire, and we'll be hearing music by Graham Ross, Thomas Tallis, John Shepherd and Bach. That's at 4 o'clock. But now it's time for the Early Music Show, a repeat of a programme broadcast for the anniversary in 2009 of the publication of Pamelia by Thomas Ravenscroft, which lays claim to being the earliest published English collection of catches and rounds. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
If I were to tell you that today's Early Music Show is on the subject of a remarkable English 17th century composer who's tied in with an anniversary this year, I expect quite a few of you would assume I was about to launch into a programme on that giant of the English Baroque, Henry Purcell. Well, if you did, you guessed wrong. He would a wooing ride, so the buckler. the consort of music there with The Marriage of the Frog and the Mouse, a traditional song arranged by Thomas Ravenscroft, who's been called one of England's most eccentric characters in an age of professed eccentrics. Clearly, we're a world away from Henry Purcell. In fact, we're some 50 years earlier than Purcell. James I is on the throne, Shakespeare's on at the Playhouse, and a new middle class is thriving as never before, enjoying the sort of modern comforts and leisure activities that we'd all recognise today. The theatre was an attraction to many, but more often the key to a convivial evening was in the company of friends, perhaps in the comfortable home of an affluent merchant or government official whose household and servants could provide copious food, good wines and a postprandial sing-song. Or, if the wines hadn't been too potent, the playing of consorts. This was just the sort of occasion for which Ravenscroft published his three volumes of popular songs. And he certainly knew his market, dedicating the contents to the well-disposed to read and the merry-disposed to sing. Here, he goes on, is harmony to please, variety to delight, facility to invite thee, some toys, yet musical, yet pleasing without difficulty. The only intent is to give general content. The Marriage of the Frog and the Mouse comes from Ravenscroft's collection Melismata, published in 1611. But this year sees the anniversary of the publication of two of his other songbooks, Deuteromelia and Parmelia, which lays claim to being the earliest published English collection of catches and rounds. Both books appeared in 1609, and as the intricately engraved title page tells us, they could be purchased at the Spread Eagle at the great north door of St. Paul's. In fact, it was on these very printing presses, housed in the little workshops around the great cathedral, and some even within the churchyard itself, that so much of London's publishing took place. And you can find a remnant of all this activity in the hall of the old Stationers' Company, which still stands just a stone's throw from the steps of St. Paul's. So we're dedicating today's early music show to Thomas Ravenscroft, a talented musician who nevertheless remains one of England's more obscure figures. The families and friends who sat down to enjoy his music would almost certainly have been familiar with some of it already. Music had a high profile in Ravenscroft's London. In fact, it was quite hard to avoid it. The theatres and taverns were alive with ballad singers and instrumentalists of all kinds and all qualities, while the traditional cries of the market traders could be surprisingly tuneful. New oysters, ripe cherries, will you buy a new broom? These short phrases provided inspiration for many composers. And we begin and end this next set with two of Ravenscroft's ingenious songs based on London street cries. In between, we'll hear Come Follow Me, a catch or round in the style of a rustic courtship ballad. Malkin was a country maid, trick and trim as she might be. But first, new oysters.